Thank you for being here. I acknowledge that the city of Hamilton, where I record this podcast, is situated upon the traditional First Nations territories of the Erie, Huron-Wendat, Haudenosaunee, Mississaugas, and the Chonodon of the so-called Neutral Tribes. Hamilton is also directly adjacent to the Haldimand Treaty Territory. Welcome to the arena, where sometimes the hardest part is showing up. My name is Linda McLaughlin. Thank you for being here. Ernie Lutit is the kind of gentle soul you might underestimate when you first meet him. It's one of the many qualities that made him such a great leader, a tenacious police officer, and as young constables have described him, a trailblazer. But to him, he's just being Ernie. Thank you for listening to this special Remembrance Day episode of The Arena. This is episode 43. We've had some fun, haven't we?
Yes. Yeah. The best meat plants never survive initial contact.
That's right. Okay, so we seem to be doing okay here. Ernie, I am so delighted we're able to do this, and we had a bit of a challenge the first time we tried this out, but here we are today. Try to get this conversation in. And it's really an honor to talk to you, as you are both a retired member of the police force, but also a retired member of the military. And so thank you on both fronts for your service.
Thank you.
You certainly went above and beyond the call of duty many times in your career. You've written three books that I have next to me here, most especially about your time working in the Saskatoon Police Force. So I guess we'll dive in. I normally have an intro for people, and my philosophy is very much jump in if I've said something that's incorrect or overblown your accomplishments or something like that.
Okay.
Ernie Lutit, you're a son, brother, father, and soon a Moshe, or grandfather. You're a Messinee Cree from Northern Ontario. You grew up in a town called Oba, which is about 1,000 kilometers or a 12.5-hour drive north of Toronto. While it is a place where you go to heal now, as a child, it was a rough start. You dropped out of school and started working on the railroad at age 15. And in 1978, at 17, you joined the military, where you stayed for 9 years. Is that correct?
Eight years.
While you served, you went to Cyprus with the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, or PPCLI. Later in your career, you became a member of the military police, stationed in Wainwright, Alberta, at the PPCLI Battle School, the largest training center in Western Canada. You were honorably discharged in 1987, and shortly thereafter you joined the Saskatoon Police, where you served as a patrol officer and then patrol sergeant for 30 years. It's kind of a neat and tidy way to summarize your career, but you were known on the streets of Saskatoon as Indian Ernie, affectionately by those you served, and not so affectionately by the people you regularly arrested. Since your retirement, you've written three books about your experiences and the lessons they taught you. Colleagues, civilians, and criminals alike have picked up your books, curious to see if their own stories might appear. Having read those books, there are a number of stories that stood out to me, including your efforts to interfere with a source of Lysol and cooking wine sold to the desperately addicted, your testimony in the Stonechild Inquiry and the Starlight Tours, which involved at least two members of the Saskatoon Police driving First Nations people to the outskirts of Saskatoon and leaving them stranded in freezing temperatures. Three men died, including 17-year-old Neil Stonechild. You proudly served in patrol for your whole career, believing you could do your best work boots on the ground, in your community, instead of from behind a desk. When you retired in 2013, you carried with you thousands of stories, experiences, and mental images, many of which you have not been able to shake. Writing and speaking about those experiences have helped, as well as a strong and supportive family. I really appreciate you speaking with me today. Welcome to the arena, Ernie.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. I think what really struck me about reading your books was how concise you were in being able to share your stories. They weren't written in a gratuitous way. They were written in a very sort of factual way, very police-like in terms of stick to the facts, but you wrote in a very humanistic way as well. You really brought the impact of what living in those neighborhoods, what patrolling certain neighborhoods in Saskatoon, the impact it had on you, but what it was like. And as a civilian who lives thousands of kilometers away from Saskatoon, I really got a sense of what that time was like, how it impacted you and how it impacted the people who lived in that community. And I believe the impact that you had as a patrolman in that community. So that was a long-winded way of saying I really admire what you've accomplished, both as a person who's dedicated their life to serving and now as a writer. It's pretty impressive.
Thank you. When I was doing all that, and I thought that's what everybody was doing. You know what I mean? And as it went on, it became very addictive. Mm. It's because patrol is an exciting place and you meet so many people and it just became addicted to that, I guess, lifestyle, if you want to call it that. And every time you had success, it was everybody's success. That's the way it felt. If someone was snipping solvents and actually stopped and actually got to life afterwards, and you had a part in that, it was a sense of accomplishment. And it didn't seem, while I was doing it, like it was a big deal. To be honest, I was kind of a loner when I came to work. I had some really good patrol partners that were like-minded people, but of course, they went on the normal paths that you do when you're a police officer, going to detectives or moving on to different branches of the police service. It just felt like that was where I belong. You can make a difference. As the experience accumulated over the years, and a lot of the stories that I wrote to teach young constables to be empathetic, to don't be in such a hurry to get to drug section, or don't be in such a hurry to get out of the places you're working, because you get more and richer experiences by dealing with the people that you're supposed to deal with for longer terms. Because a lot of guys would work a district for 2 years and then you go try another district, or work a district like the ones I work, and then after a couple of years, seeing that the difference you could make over the long term if you stuck in patrol, and then after a couple of years, head over to the quiet side of town and then work the way through the detective stuff like that. But I tried to teach them that they were missing things. They were missing one place for as long as you could until people knew you and you knew the people. And I think that made a significant difference in the way I felt about police, because those people were part of my life as well. Well, the guy you would arrest every 2 weeks, and he knew who you were and you knew who he was, and you knew his addictions. You could suggest how he could get help, but you knew he wouldn't take it. He had a little expression every time you arrest him. His very easy, chalk it up, Ernie. Chalk it up, Ernie. And so you almost looked forward to deal with him because you knew he was going to be funny. Sometimes he'd be angry when if he was hungover and he got picked up, and he'd have to deal with sobriety for a little while until he dealt with his warrants or whatever. But most of the time, he was just a funny guy. Right? And there were so many people like that over the years in Saskatoon. And then getting their backstories was a huge part, too. Once you get past that initial hostility when an arrest takes place, when you're booking them in and get talking to them, where are you from? And, you know, so I'm from way up north. And well, how'd you get here? And they tell their story. And the way you viewed people changed, including people that weren't criminals, that you just saw people that hung out or stuck in certain neighborhoods, like a furniture store for 40 years in a family in a rough part of town that had to put up with some discarded needles in their back alley, or people that would drink or pass out in their back alley. Just how everybody understood each other. Mm-hmm. And some people complained bitterly, and other people were just, you know, already, could you drop by on Friday? Because they're going to be drinking in the back of my business and I'm trying to deliver furniture or whatever.
So you embraced the moniker Indian Ernie when you were on the streets. That was or you accepted it, maybe whether you embraced it or not, I'm not sure. But
yeah, because it was identifiable. And it started from the kids in the neighborhoods I worked at. And I just did things differently. If I didn't have a call, I'd get in my car and walk around. and walk around, not where the businesses were, but like just neighborhoods in general, and the places where you very rarely saw the police unless there was a call. And there's always one brave kid in every neighborhood that's going to see what you're doing, and they'd come follow you. And as soon as you turn around, they're gone, rage took off. Next time you come back, there's a brave kid, a couple of his buddies. And eventually it worked up the courage to ask what I was doing there. Why are you here? And I said, my work here. What are you doing? It's walking around. And then the one would say, what's your name? And I said, it's Aaron. Okay. And then, are you an Indian? And these were young First Nations kids. I said, yeah. So after that, every time I showed up, people would say, it's Indian Aaron. And then eventually people added things to Indian Aaron, depending on the side of the law you're on. But long and short of it is, I became an identifiable part of the community, whether you like me or not. And yeah. That's right up to the end of my career. Like a good example of how I did impact in a community was, and I didn't know they were doing this, but the bad guys that were wanted, or the bad girls, or would call communications to see if I was working. They say, is Indian Aaron working? Oh, not, no, he'll be out tomorrow. So they go get smokes or white drugs or get a do or try to. And so I started changing my hours around. And this one girl I've been looking for, she had eight frog horns. And she had called comms that morning. I didn't know that. And I hadn't booked on onto the computer because I didn't want to go to any meetings. So I booked on once I got on the street. And there I see her walking. So I jump up. They said, gotcha. He said, you got all these words. That's not fair. And I called to make sure you weren't working. And they told me you weren't booked on. So... yeah, you could have a little bit of impact even in a city of 300,000. So
that's amazing. That's awesome.
And I've had every name you can have too: Indian, Indigenous, Aboriginal, First Nations. Yeah, I don't care what you call me. As long as you're be nice about it. But besides that, in the 2000s, Indigenous didn't even sound it. That wasn't a very good title.
Yeah, it's a lot to sort of yell across the street or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meeting you and trying to imagine you as the action figure, Ernie, I have a hard time sort of computing. I have no doubt it's in you, but you were pretty rough and ready, and you had to be just in the work in the streets. What was dinner conversation like in your household?
Well, our family was pretty close. My formative years would be in Northern Ontario. And we lived in a small two-house. There's four kids, my mom, and who's now my stepdad. Been with my mom for 50 years. And my uncle who slept on a couch in the living room. And cool little lamps and wood stove. And we had a small oil stove, but it was only used at night, but he didn't have it going all day. We were really close. The kitchen was the social center, like a lot of farm. And my mom was an avid reader, so a lot of our conversations were around books. We only get CBC North on the radio, one of those little radios with a coat hanger for an antenna that ran on batteries and seemed to last forever. Yeah. Barbara Frum and As It Happens and all that stuff were usually what prompted conversations in the house. And so it's just a good time. It was like we're by any means rich or well-to-do or anything like that. So it wasn't that day-to-day struggle that went on, but it always gave you that purpose, like home water, because we didn't have running water. There was a well behind our place, but it wasn't drinkable. So we used to haul water in buckets from the railway station, chopping wood, snaring rabbits to supplement the food sources, fishing. It was a fair hike to our school. Our school was pretty unique because it was a one-room school. There was an apartment in the back for the teachers, but what would normally happen with the teachers is they would be teachers that had been blackballed in the cell, either had been for drinking or and this was the last resort for them. And the first couple of teachers I had there were the one in particular used to actually drink while he was teaching. He'd hear everyone screw in a wine bottle and he'd say, Mr. Larkin's just going to have some more tea. But we all knew because everybody knew what drank at the time or lots of people drank. And as the day went on, he'd start slurring, and he was a such a character. He kept his shirt button right to the very top button, and always wore long sleeves. He had two sons living with him, in his little apartment. There were students there as well. But he was the one that told me probably grade 3, grade 4, that I'd better learn to do something with my hands because I wasn't going to amount to anything.
Oh, my God.
And after he left, we got a guy from the South that was just dynamic, just a dynamic guy. And he was very worldly and stuff. And I think what happened, this is back in the 60s now, is he was gay. And back then, you couldn't openly be gay, I guess, in some Ontario school system. So he came up to teach Nova, and he was just an amazing man. He actually bought his own money in the first VCR when it came out for, and showed us like the moon landing and clips from the news and stuff like that, because none of us had TVs. And I'd really emphasize on the reading and stuff. And he was, but he drank lots too. And eventually my last teacher broke the mold because she was the top candidate of her teaching class. And I was coming up to teach us pretty much undisciplined kids. And I was always 2 years younger than most of the kids that were in school. And so I was the odd man out. And I used to get beat up a lot because I was short, heavy, and mouthy, I guess. And those don't really work out. And just a lot of the foundations of my character came from that. My mother and her love of reading, the teachers I had, except for the drunk guy, that made me learn to love reading. As well, we didn't have a library. We had a couple of shelves with books on them, but there is an Encyclopedia Britannica there. And then all the books that the big school systems didn't want, or that were outdated, they just shipped over. And there was one, I think it was a 1950 or 60s textbook, what was the history of Canada. And of course, being First Nations, I was always looking for references to us, and not finding very many, short of the history they taught back then, the brush over residential schools and all that stuff like that. It was very isolated, but it was very formative for me because that's where, I love that sense of community. At least you knew everybody, even if it wasn't good, at least you knew everybody. And that love of nature, love of reading, which is, to me, is one of the most important skills you could have as a person, especially in our country. And there was a fair amount of violence, but it just seemed the way life was, I guess. Some of my friends, I knew that their fathers beat the mothers and beat them sometimes. And you tried to be there for them, but of course, you're just kids, so you can't really do anything about it. You tell your mom. And there was two hotels, and sometimes our entertainment was to hang around the front of the bars on Friday nights and see who got the fights, right? So violence, I didn't like it, but it seemed to be just loads everywhere. And there was one particular kid, his mother used to get beat so bad. And we'd come and tell them in it. They would straighten it out. We weren't allowed to stick around for that part. We had to go away for high school to Hearst. And we'd used to take that train on Sunday, and we'd come back on Saturday. And when I first got to Hearst, they put me up in boarding houses. And and the Board of Education paid for it. And I think my mom had to pay a little bit as well. But anybody that's ever been billeted, I guess the sports guys could probably relate to this. A lot of times you're not part of the house you stay in. And some people are just doing it for money. And a lot of kids that are foster care could probably relate to that really well. Adults that were in the foster system. And you never felt really, truly welcome. And then same in high school, because it was predominantly French high school. And we were kids from the bush, right? The older kids. And they weren't style, you didn't fit in. I think disco was the big thing back then. Right. And so you had fights in high school, and you had bad experiences in boarding homes. But for the positive things, I did have some really good friends at Hearst. I had an English teacher, Mr. Mull, and the old Ontario system. I used to go to grade 13 when I was in high school. I loved English so much with him that I took grade 9 English in the first semester, grade 10 in the second semester. And then same, I did 10 and 11 in grade 10. And then before I quit school, I did grade 12 English all because he was such a dynamic teacher. But the rest of the high school just wasn't working out. So yeah, I ended up quitting and went to work on a tie game, it was called, changing the ties of the railway for the summer, and made some good money and traveled a bit. And then when it came time to go back to school, I went back and gave it a little whirl for a couple of weeks, and I thought, no, I missed the money. So I went back to Raleigh and worked there till I was 17.
So you wandered past a recruitment center.
Yes.
And ended up joining the military.
Yeah. Me and my buddy were in North Bay, Ontario. And I just walked down the street and I heard that there was a terrible recruiting sound. The youth school, there's no life like in there.
In the yellow pages under recruiting.
And I looked over, there was this sandwich board of a soldier there, a sergeant with his combat gear on, his helmet, his rifle, and boots shining, all that stuff. And when I walked in there, the sergeant behind the desk looks up and like I was going to rob the place. That's the expression. I had long hair and a white tee jacket because
it was the 70s.
Yeah. And, I've told the story a few times, but he was very doubtful that I was sincere, and you could tell he just wanted to get ready. And after I took an aptitude test, he told me I had 2 hours to write it, and then it was done in half an hour. And then when I was done, he was using whatever they used to mark it, and he came out. His attitude was totally changed. He said, "You could be anything you want when the Canadian Forces step to pilot because you don't have the education." And so it was a pretty pivotal moment for me because no one had ever told me anything like that before. And but this time I made up my mind I wanted to be in the infantry because they had machine guns and the rocket launchers and grenades. It was right up my alley. I love the bush and I love to be outside. And he tried to dissuade me from it. And an officer from the PPCLI, who was the senior ranking officer at the recruiting center, took me in, you know, I said, a good choice. And the next thing you know, I swore these oaths of allegiance after I got my medical. But I was only 17, so I had to go back up to Northern Ontario. So my mom could sign me in. Yeah. So that took a bit of convincing. She told me I was too gentle a soul, that the army would be too hard for me. And then I told the alternative, right? A roughneck kid on the rally might have a future, might not, but eventually she gave in and signed. So that was the slap shot that got me in the game.
What event in your life has had the most profound impact on you?
Depending what part of your life, I suppose professionally it was in the military, joining the army. Mm-hmm. It was anybody that knew me before that would have never thought that that's where I'm going. Personally, of course, getting married.
Mm-hmm. Good answer in case your wife is listening.
Getting married and having our children, of course. There. And everything else flowed from there. I've always been really observant of good leadership. And we're all capable of doing that kind of stuff. I call them leadership bumps. A person says to you at a certain time, it's perfect, makes a suggestion, and not realizing that has a significant impact on the person that you said it to's life. Because when I was working on the railway, there was my foreman, when we were working away, and he says, "Well, you're a good worker." He says, "You should join the army." And that's all he said. We do that all the time, whether we realize or not. And I that was probably the little leadership bump that bumped me to think, hey, I should join you. I've been beneficiary of a lot of those over my time. And I hope I give a lot of them to other people too. When I first got to the army, I don't want to do too much army talking, but at first, basic training, it's hard. I did not do well because I thought it would be right to the shooting and to the field and digging trenches and stuff. And it's still shining and polishing it and learning life skills that they teach everything from soul to polishing your boots and discipline. Now, in retrospect, I realize why it was so hard is because they gave you so many tasks that you couldn't possibly do them. So you had to prioritize. And at first, I didn't have that maturity or ability to figure that out. I figured out once I went to Miles that there's some stuff you can let slide, but the stuff that needs to be done needs to be done. Well, when I was in the battle school, I had the fortune of having a section commander guy, and I'm going to name him because hopefully he'll listen to this, because he was another guy that made a lot of difference in my life, a guy named Mike Spella. And he was my house corporal of our section. As we go to the battle school, he would give me tasks. He'd say, "Get the guys to do this, or get the guys to do that, or you're in charge of this." And so the one day I asked him, he says, "How come I never see you sleep? I've never seen you eat." He goes, "I sleep when you guys all slept. I eat when I know y'all have eaten." And then I asked him, I said, why do you keep giving me all these leadership rules? And he said, because in reality, we could go to war tomorrow. And if I get killed in the first day, you're going to be the guy in charge. And through that conversation, I knew right then that that would be my philosophy for my professional life is train my replacement from day one. As soon as I got good at something, I did it for somebody that was coming up behind me. And I wanted them to be better than me. I talked to Mike Lee years later. They never even thought about it. He just did it as a matter of course, part of being a leader. But it was one of those leadership bumps that stuck with me for my whole life. And still to this day, I need somebody, if I could point him in the right direction as well.
I love the leadership bump. That's so true, how you have a conversation with one person and suddenly that just changes the trajectory.
Exactly. So. And lots of examples like that in my life. The underlying discipline through where you had to get up and you had to go PT and you had to present yourself. You had to do your missions when you were in the field and all that stuff like that. That kind of solidified the foundation I take it from over and solidified the discipline. Mm-hmm. And it was with the help of a lot of people, but that underlying discipline where there's no quitting. That's where that came from, especially the Army. There was no quitting. I had my mom telling me that when I called from basic training and asking if I could come home, she said, no, finish what you started. So you're thousands of miles away from home and forced to finish what you started. And so that bedrock of discipline though, was really solidified in the military for me.
That's a leadership bump from your mom too. I mean, well, it was finish what you start. It's classic tough love, but.
She told me that after I retired from the military and police that she cried for weeks after, that's what she needs to do. Because she's thinking about her kid out there far away from home.
What have I done? Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, those huge things.
You're a poster child for having lived a courageous life on a lot of different levels. What does living a courageous life mean to you?
Integrity. You need to have it as your bedrock and discipline. You got to love people. You're surrounded by how many million? You need to love the people. You can't do it to everybody. I'm not like kumbaya. There's just some awful people out there. But the majority, the vast majority of the people that encounter in life, might be having some rough patches here and there, but there's a basic human decency. And you can always draw that out. And if you do that and you're drawing out people's basic decency, whether they're conscious of you doing it or not, I think you're helping them to live courageously, which makes you live courageously. That's, I know it's a tough question, but the first answer is usually the most honest. So I believe if you could make people see and live courageously, then you're living courageously yourself. If you can make people see their basic good nature, right? Then you're on the right path there. That's my opinion of it.
Choosing to remain in patrol your entire career and giving up opportunities to progress to major crimes or some of these other areas of policing, you considered them, but ultimately, as you mentioned, was driven somewhat by being a bit of an adrenaline junkie, being at the tip of the spear in policing and being in those neighborhoods. But you brought such compassion to your work in those communities. As a First Nations person, we're often dealing with First Nations people in pretty shitty circumstances and dealing with their own demons. You were called names on all sides. It's just a lot to try and wrap into one person's life. And through reading your books, I just saw, and what you said was just perfect in terms of just being who you are and showing someone compassion and encouraging their courage to allow you to be courageous.
Did I get it right every time? No, not even close. Did I get it close to right? I just said not even close. But somehow, somewhere, it resonated with some people or a lot of people. Even after I retired, guys that I used to deal with, criminals, would still walk up to me and still felt compelled to tell you their stories. And it's reciprocity. It's if you're kind to people and even when they're in their worst circumstances at some level, somewhere, it's going to come back to you. There's times when I was a hard aspect to some people, especially repeat offenders and drug offenders. But if you want to call it the battle or the chase, whatever the interaction was done, As long as you didn't gloat, you were okay. And they're cursed, but urged. But as long as you didn't rub it in, because you already accomplished what you were trying to accomplish, you stopped the behavior. And some guys would never, ever tell you that. Or I say guys all the time, because I'm ex-Army, everything's guys. They remember that. People remember that. And we talk about that every day, actually. My wife and I and the kids, I have to keep telling the kids the same thing all the time. It's easier to smile at somebody and say thank you than it is to butt heads. Even if the person's rude to you, you just say, hey, thanks, I'm sorry you feel that way, but let's carry on. And that basic, like I said, reciprocity. I remember the first time I read that word, I went, ooh, I like that. Because it's true. It's human nature. If you're kind to somebody, even if you're doing hard business, it'll come back. Mm-hmm. It'll come back to you. And certainly, like after I retired, because I wasn't sure how things were going to go, of course, because I was going 150 miles an hour for so long, and all of a sudden, boom, I was done. And I wasn't sure how it would go. So many people, their whole identity is tied up in their profession, and they forget who they are as a person. And I was afraid that that's where I was. And so after retiring, all of a sudden, I go, wow, I've misreviewed it now for the first time since 1978. Not private, not corporal, not sergeant. You know, you don't have a badge number, nothing. I'm just Mr. And I'm wondering what I'd done in the preceding years, if I'd wrecked them or not, right? If I'd be able to let go of that old blame style. And I found that, like I said, all the foundation that you'd lay down actually was humbled by how things went. And in policing, yeah, because it's so fast and hard. You used to have a say that 20 feet or 20 seconds is how long they'll remember you when you leave. And in some respects, that's true, but that's the nature of the business because they can't be telling you about homicide investigations or drug investigations and stuff like that. And they're still doing them. They're still working them. But the friends that I, over the years, from the community, from the law profession, the lawyers, defense lawyers, judges, other policemen, those friendships blossomed after I left. And it was the biggest one, of course, was my wife. when we were both working and things were going on all the time. And you forget how funny and how genuine a person that's why I married in the first place. But you just forgot that, how amazingly funny she is, right? Now when she enjoyed time together. Yeah, laying down that foundation, I'm glad she stuck with me through all this because there were certainly times when a lot of people probably would have made it.
You faced death. You've watched people die. That was a big part of your life. What would you do on your last day?
Oh, my gosh. Well, hopefully I won't know it's my last day.
You'll leave that a surprise.
Yeah. All the smile and shake hands with everybody the way I normally do it. And if I know it's my last day, I guess I'll just make sure everybody I love has got what they need. And if I'm still capable of giving them anything to take with them, I certainly will. Especially with my own, I shouldn't say children, my kids, but they're all adults now. But I just want them to not worry about stuff they shouldn't worry about. And if you really sit back and look at it, it was probably wasn't worth worrying about in the first place. Right? There's some things that are important and a lot of stuff, especially with, I feel bad for young people with social media. And what a toxic place that is. And then you have little rock stars that are out there. I'll give you a plug here, but for your podcast, that's a rock star podcast because it's a positive message and it's a positive thing. And like I said, what I think is limit courageously, if you could help other people live courageously, if you're doing that, then you're living courageously. That's the best way to put it. But if they could get away from all the toxic stuff that's out there and not everything is a crisis. And when I speak to seniors, when I did a lot of public speaking before COVID came, when I talk to seniors and I always say, how many people here think the world's falling apart? And you'll see the heads nodding and the knitting of the hands. And I said, it's not. I said, there's problems. He said, but if you could go back and look at a newspaper from 1900, and you have diseases, you have disasters, you have anarchists or terrorists. And you have war, you have conflict, and corrupt governments and all that stuff. It's all there in the papers. But the difference between 1900 and 2022 or 2021 is in 1900, you had to wait till the paper got there. And it might be 2 weeks removed from the event, or even if you had a radio, they would just play it once, and after that, it was music and cereals. But nowadays, you can go in your kitchen at 80 years old, turn your TV on, and let the news cycle go through every 30 minutes. And mm-hmm. if that doesn't make you, especially as seniors, you feel more vulnerable as you get older. If that doesn't make you scared, I mean, what else will? Because the world is just the world. If you take a look to the left, you take a look to the right, you'll see it's not all that bad. Mm-hmm. Most of us, right? Unless you have a disease or something that you're battling. But for the majority of people, if you just stop for a second and look down your street or to your left and right, you got everything you need. Don't have to like the government, but at least we have one. And then every couple of years, we can get rid of them if we want to. There's places in this world that type of freedom is just not available. And people die for wanting to vote. I'd like people to keep it in perspective. If they truly reflect on most of their lives are not too bad. And if they can help people's lives that are bad, give it a shot. Give it a shot.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your legacy?
I don't know what it's going to be. I'm not done yet. First fiction book's coming.
Your fiction is a thriller? Is it a love story? Is it a bit of both?
It's a bit of everything. It's not a cop book. When I got the editorial review, which was the first time it's reviewed, her first line was, "This is an excellent book." So anyway, because it's got everything: forest fires, game wardens, police, families, long courts, and it goes across a couple generations. So it was fun to write. Now the nitpicky stuff starts. But
yeah.
Looking forward to this. Depending what friends and legacy, I never used to think when I retired, one of the young and beautiful constables and assessing police signals, "You're a trailblazer." And I was like, "What do you mean?" So you're a trailblazer. I says, "No," he says, "You're all trailblazers right now." I don't know what my legacy will be when I'm done. I'm not even sure I'm not done yet. That's why I guess I just hope that people, say, "That Ernie, you don't have to like him, but he was true and right a lot." or he made a difference or whatever the case is. I was talking to some of the constables that are still working after retired. And the one constable said, she said that we were at a call and there was, I think, three or four of them at this call. And they all looked at each other, "What would Ernie do?" So I guess that's legacy. What would Ernie do? And now I've got people doing papers on my books. Everyone's probably contacted. I just wanted to ask you this. One of my daughter's friends is doing an essay on the first book, I think. She was texting my daughter. My daughter's really proud of that. Said it was. And so I guess that's the legacy in the long run. Yeah, if I made people think differently and they can associate my name with it, then I guess that's a legacy. I never really, like you said, really thought about it before. But there's been that constable. We looked at each other and said, "What would Ernie do?"
If you had 5 minutes to have a conversation with somebody living or dead, who would that be?
I always said Tecumseh. Because he was one of my heroes when I was growing up. I was never General Brock, because they thought it was stupid to run up a hill and get shot. Weed and sword. Tecumseh, because from what I read historically, he had a vision and he just couldn't get all the cats herded together. But he had a significant impact that kind of still resonates, especially in that southern Ontario part where, and Ohio and like where all the places he wrote. I thought he had a real significant impact. Now, and if I had a second one, I think just because he was so ballsy, he'd be Winston Churchill.
Wow, that's a contrast. Okay.
Yeah, just because Tecumseh didn't have a written record, but Churchill did. And of the millions of words he wrote, there's so many quotable quotes that absolutely apply to life. The one I liked the most was, and I can never say this word, but it was be defiant and defeat and magnanimous. Magnanimous, yes, that's the word.
That word, yes.
Yeah. And because that always made sense to me. If you lost at something or whatever, you try harder. And if you succeed at something that comes at someone else's cost, you should never do the football dance or the touchdown dance. I remember reading that when I was a kid and I just went, I love that saying. I could never say the word, though. I tried selling it out many times, then just gave up. Don't do the football.
I've always said ambience as opposed to ambulance. So we all have the word that we've got. And just for the listeners, who is to come say? Because I have listeners all over the world.
Oh, Tecumseh was a Shawnee chief back in the early 1800s. While North America was still getting itself sorted out. And she was a great warrior, and she tried to unite the people of the Ohio Valley and southern Ontario to stave off the American advance to their homelands. And he sided with the British. Unfortunately, that cost him his life during the War of 1812. But he was a man of vision. I think if he'd have survived, I think he would have slowed down the American advance.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Yes. Live your life courageously, as courageously as you can. And then I thank you for making me define what I thought living courageously is, because I always had an idea of what I thought it was, but I never had to articulate it before. People listening to your podcast would sit back for a minute after the end of an episode and just think, what's living courageously to me? And they'll probably find that it's not too different from what we believe. If you live courageously, people will live courageously by your example.
Mm-hmm. No, I certainly believe that. I believe the stories that you've shared and that others have shared, they'll find their own leadership bumps through those words. They'll find those moments of inspiration to tip them over into a moment of courage in their own life. And so that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, for sure.
Awesome. And look for them, because they're there all the time. And if you can give them, give them. Right. Like I said, you never know where it's going to go.
Absolutely. That's a perfect way to end up. So thank you so much for this, Ernie. And this has been really inspiring for me. I've loved reading your books. And so all three of them, this Indian Ernie, Perspectives on Policing and Leadership. There's More Indian Ernie, Insights from the Streets. And then most recently, The Unexpected Cop, Indian Ernie on a Life of Leadership. I really appreciate you speaking with me today.
Thank you.
I'll share in the show notes where you can buy Ernie's books and find out more about his story. I'd encourage you to support your local bookstore, such as McNally Robinson's if you live in the prairies, Epic Books if you live in Hamilton, and Ben McNally's or Type if you're in Toronto, to name a few. Ernie got his start as a writer from a small independent press, and it would be great to make sure we continue to support small businesses wherever you reside. And whether you're listening to this episode on Remembrance Day or not, I hope you'll take a moment to reflect on the sacrifices made by the men and women in uniform who keep our country and our streets safe. Miigwech, Ernie. Thank you for your service. And thank you for listening. Please follow or subscribe to this podcast. And if you feel someone else might benefit from listening to this episode, please share it. Leave a rating or review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Become a member of The Arena. Go to my website, thearena-podcast.com, and click on the support button. It's so greatly appreciated. I look forward to sharing my next guest's story. She helps her clients embrace the concept that dying is all a part of living. Until next time, my name is Linda McLaughlin in The Arena.